are now available.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta now offers a private dining room for parties, meetings, and other events. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff of The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. It's hour two of our show. I'm David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. The following program comes from the Focus 580 archive, so that means for the next hour, we'll not be taking your calls. We remember Abraham Lincoln as being one of the great presidential speechmakers. Yet, very little has been written about the speech that took him from local Illinois politician to viable national candidate. This was a speech that he delivered in the winter of 1860 in New York. It was delivered before the Republican establishment there, and many who gathered to watch him expected him to fail. Instead, the speech was a triumph, and the public relations campaign that followed helped secure for Abraham Lincoln the Republican presidential nomination. This morning, we'll be talking about the speech with Harold Holzer. He has authored, co-authored, and edited 22 books on Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War. And his newest is all about this speech. It's entitled Lincoln at Cooper Union. The subtitle is The Speech That Made Abraham Lincoln President. It's published by Simon & Schuster. And in the book, Harold Holzer does indeed make the argument that this speech has been overlooked. And its significance in Lincoln's political career is great. To say the least. As we talk this morning with Harold Holzer, certainly questions, comments are welcome. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call. The only thing we ask of people who call in is that they're brief so that we can get in as many people as possible and keep moving. But anyone who is listening is certainly welcome to participate. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana, anywhere the signal will travel. Even if you should happen to be listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you can use that number. That's 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Mr. Holzer, hello.
Hi.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
We appreciate it. In the introduction to the book, you note the fact that while people, historians, those who know about the life of and career of Abraham Lincoln, have considered this speech, the Cooper Union speech, to be important, at the same time, you write that it has been virtually ignored by generations of historians, most of whom have relegated it to the status of exalted footnote. And then you go on to make the argument that, in fact, that is probably one of the most famous of Lincoln's speeches that almost no one today ever reads, and also that it was very important to Lincoln's career. Why do you think that this particular speech has been so overlooked?
I think there are two basic reasons. One is simple and one is a little more complicated. The simple reason is that it's so dauntingly long. It's 7,715 words, 10 times as long as the second inaugural address and 35 times as long as the Gettysburg Address. To make it even more challenging, it's really three speeches in one, three different kinds of approaches, each of which is abruptly stopped and then a new kind of approach begun. So it's long, it's complex. It's harder for us to understand what beguiled an audience reading a speech like this than it is to understand why a masterpiece like the Gettysburg Address affected people. And then the second reason is that it's really unlike anything Lincoln ever did. All his speeches before this were more stump frontier oratory. This was more scholarly and restrained and legalistic. And really, most of the speeches after this had quite a different style, more poetic, again, more elegiac, beginning with his farewell to Springfield about a year later. So it stands there in the middle, singular and complicated, and it's been a challenge.
Certainly, we know from the time, and you note the fact that at this time, a lot of people, many Americans, were politically engaged, and exactly. Political speech was a something like this would have been a real event that people would have wanted to go to, wanted to hear, both I think for its significance just as an event, and also for the ideas. Would a speech like this, by today's standards, this would be long and difficult. And when Sam Waterston redid it not very long ago, one of the quotes I know from him was something like, I'm interested to see if people will sit still for it.
Yeah.
At the time, though, would it have been unusual?
Not at all. People just loved political oratory. It was combined the traveling tent show, the state fair, a day in church without sermonizing. People flocked to political speeches indoors and outdoors, and thrived on it. As you pointed out, 80% voter turnout in 1860, albeit white males only, but it's still a huge turnout. And to show you what the endurance quotient was, after Lincoln finished his speech, the audience did not rush out to the parking lot or whatever the 1860 equivalent of the parking lot was. You know, you go to the theater today and people can't wait to beat their friends and strangers out to be the first out. After the Cooper Union address, after an hour and 40 minutes or so, not to mention one or two speeches that preceded it, the election of a chairman of the evening that preceded it, then Lincoln's 90 minutes, and then the audience wouldn't go home. They called for more speeches, five more speeches. Not as long as Lincoln's, but five commentaries. People just had an insatiable appetite for political discourse.
Yeah. You know, I was having a discussion about this with my wife, as a matter of fact, last night as I was reading the book, and we were talking about the level of political engagement of people at the time. And I said I thought, well, perhaps part of the reason that people might have been excited by an event like this was it was considered a kind of entertainment.
Oh, absolutely.
And she sort of said, well, she wasn't comfortable with that word. I think she understood, as you did, the level of political engagement that people had. And I was wanting to make the argument that it could, in fact, be, I would like to rehabilitate the word entertainment. I say, yes, you could certainly be engaged with the ideas, and I'm sure that people were, but at the same time, my feeling was that it was a kind of entertainment.
You know, it certainly was a combination. First, I think you're right, and so is your wife, that people were more informed. In the absence of radio and C-SPAN and CNN and all of the access to sound bites, I'm obviously not talking about a show like this where you get to talk in detail, where people just expect information to be delivered to them quickly and effortlessly and move on to the next thing. People read newspapers. They read transcripts of speeches if they couldn't get to them themselves. They read pamphlets. And when these speakers came to town, people about whom they only read in the press or in pamphlets, they wanted to take the measure of them in person to see how they sounded and how they looked and how they gestured. And with Lincoln, that was always amusing because he was so awkward when he spoke. So it was definitely a combination. And in New York, a little difficult to get a crowd because there was so much going on in New York, like today. Theater events, opera, other lectures. I looked around carefully at all the entertainment ads for the day, and Lincoln had a lot of competition that day. A minstrel show, a menagerie, an equestrian show, a lecture on digestive organs. People wouldn't want to miss that. So there was New York was a hot town then, and Lincoln didn't quite fill the hall. Sam Waterston did, but Lincoln didn't.
Yeah. Well, and it also cost money to attend this event. It was only at 25 cents, but my guess would be at that time, 25 cents would not be an insignificant amount
cheap.
Of money.
Straight inflation index says it's about $5 today, but then, you know, it probably was more for people who didn't make that much money. It was an investment, and some people might have figured that they could hear a political speaker next time around outdoors, because there were always those opportunities as well.
Let me just very quickly reintroduce our guest, Harold Holzer. He's the author of the newly published book, Lincoln at Cooper Union, the speech that made Abraham Lincoln president, by Simon & Schuster. That's the publisher. And indeed, it is a story of this particular speech that he gave. This was in February of 1860 in New York, that Harold Holzer argues was very important to helping him to secure the Republican nomination for presidency that year. Questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We should put this in context, I guess. Maybe I'll ask you to talk a little bit about where Lincoln was in his political career at this time.
Well, he had, of course, lost the Senate race against Stephen A. Douglas in 1858, but in 1859 had been called upon to give speeches in behalf of Senate and gubernatorial candidates running nationally in other states. I'd like to remind people that elections didn't take place every 2 years in those days. There was an election every year. In fact, there was an important election almost every month somewhere in the country. It was rather decentralized, according to dates, anyway. So Lincoln had just gone on a big speaking tour, and all the candidates he supported and spoke for won. So he was on the ascent, really, emerging as a national figure. And, in fact, the very day that he came home from celebrating the big Republican Party triumphs around the country, in October 1859, he actually received a telegram inviting him to speak in New York, in Brooklyn, to be precise, according to the first invitation. So it was a momentous day, and even on a day that he was celebrating a triumph, he looked forward to another big opportunity.
Who was it that issued the invitation to him to come to New York?
A group called the Young Men's Central Republican Union. They were a club that had organized for the 1856 presidential election, and they were intent on finding alternatives to the favorite son in New York, who was William H. Seward, the senator from New York, disliked by many New York City people because he was an upstater. And these were guys who were looking for an alternative. So they invited a series of Westerners to come east and lecture in New York. And Lincoln was the one who was the last of them and made the biggest impression.
Yeah. Being an Illinoisan, I like the idea that Illinois is the West.
It was definitely the West.
Yes, at that time it was. They thought of Lincoln or people from this part of the country as Westerners.
Absolutely. Don't we still in New York? You know.
The invitation to Lincoln, in addition to including an honorarium, was wide open as to subject matter. They said, we would like you to come and give a speech on the subject of your choice. How did he go about deciding what it was that he wanted to talk about?
I don't think he had any doubt, nor did his host, that the subject he would choose would be politics. He was, at that time, sort of creating a third career for himself as a lecturer. He liked the idea of giving lectures that were not speeches. He had gotten a very bad reaction to his first major effort in this line, a lecture on discoveries and inventions, which was actually really dreary, and people were paying for that and not enjoying it. So he thought a political lecture would be in order, and well, no one doubted he'd speak about slavery and the current state of the division between the North and the South. The fact that he did it in a lecture format as an historical and legalistic lecture to prove that the federal government had the right to restrict the spread of slavery is what made it particularly appealing.
Mm-hmm. He apparently set out very carefully to prepare and research the lecture, which he saw as indeed more than a speech. And that would obviously suggest how important he felt this could be to his political future. Was he indeed thinking about it that way?
About the presidency?
If not the presidency, I guess there was some thought that if Seward was indeed the Republican nominee, that he might be the vice president.
Yeah, I'm not willing to concede that Lincoln wasn't thinking about the top spot. The vice presidency would have been interesting, but it really was fairly boring, even more than now. The vice president had no responsibilities except to preside over the Senate when it was in session. They didn't share the Oval Office area with the president. They didn't go to lunch once a week, as we've heard recently that President Bush 41 used to do with President Reagan. They weren't intimately involved with affairs or cabinet meetings the way Vice President Gore was with President Clinton. So it was, you know, it was a job that was offered for regional balance and not much else. I think Lincoln had his eyes set on the top prize from the very beginning. He was calculated. If he was going to be chosen, it wasn't going to be for vice president. It wasn't going to be for disrupting the party's plans to have Seward emerge as a sort of a seamless and universally accepted nominee.
Hmm. So how did he go about crafting this lecture?
Well, he was inspired by something he read. William H. Seward was clearly one rival, but he also was looking to his longtime Democratic foe, Stephen A. Douglas, who had defeated him for the Senate in 58. Douglas published an article in Harper's Magazine called The Dividing Line, in which he made the argument, in this very liberal newspaper, a very liberal magazine, by the way, in which he made the point that that the federal government had no authority to control the spread of slavery, that was perpetually vested in the majority rule of the people who lived in those new territories. Lincoln read the article and was gripped by one phrase in it. Douglas said, to justify that the Constitution guaranteed this state authority, that our fathers, meaning the fathers of our country, understood this question, meaning slavery, just as well or better than we do now. Something about that phrase interested and compelled Lincoln. Who were the fathers, he wondered. Well, why not the framers of the Constitution? That's the government under which we live. What did they really think about federal control as to slavery? Well, the answer is not just in the Constitution, which was a compromise document that those fathers were compelled to approve in order to move forward and create a government. What about their subsequent votes, if they had any, as congressmen, as senators? So he set about investigating what all of the 39 framers had done, how they'd expressed themselves on subsequent slavery issues, like whether to allow slavery in the Northwest Territory, whether to allow slavery in the Louisiana Purchase, whether to allow slavery in other territories of the United States, how they voted on the Missouri Compromise in 18, 19, and 20, if they lived that long. And with mathematical precision, he found that 21 of the 39 had voted clearly to authorize the federal government to control the spread of slavery. So he decided to answer Douglas and Seward at once.
One of the little bits of the story that I think is interesting, just because it says something to you about what life at the time would have been like, is your account of just how difficult a journey it would have been to get from Springfield, where Lincoln was living, to New York City. It was all by
rail. Not that easy now.
Actually, it's not that easy now. It was all by rail, involved many trains. It involved sometimes changing trains in the middle of the night, and it sounds like it would have been just a completely exhausting process just to make the trip.
3 days and three nights, no sleepers, you know, upright chairs, no dining cars. You had to race out and grab your meals when the train was picking up water. And Lincoln was saddled with a relative, a young woman with a child, a two-year-old boy, and anyone who has traveled with a two-year-old, even on a short flight, knows that that is not the easiest thing in the world, even if you're not going to be giving the speech of your life in the next few days.
Mm-hmm.
So he arrived a tired man in New York.
Yeah. When the people that brought him got a look at him, mm-hmm. What were their first impressions?
That they had made a terrible mistake. That this fellow, who was so awkward and so huge and wrinkled, and his face so disheveled and wrinkled and pockmarked and hair standing out all over the place, that this kind of presentation might work on the stump in Illinois, but it was going to be an unmitigated disaster in New York. Mm. In fact, the people who heard him at Cooper Union in the first few minutes were convinced of the same thing. He spoke before a group that was called the Pick and Flower of New York Culture, and they were, as most audiences were, fixated on the awkward gestures, the long legs, until they began to be swept up into the argument. I'm always interested in people's reactions, the published reactions by contemporaries to Lincoln's speeches. They all seem to say that after 10 minutes, they were transfixed. It's always 10 minutes. Hmm. And it must have been some gong that went off. Let's stop looking at the gestures and start listening.
Well, does that, I wonder, though, how much that indeed had to do simply with the text, or was it also his ability to put it across, and maybe it just took him a little bit of warming up to be as effective a presenter as he was capable of?
Well, they say, those who reported it, that his voice was harsh and a little bit shrill until he warmed up his vocal cords. Mm-hmm. People have interpreted that and misinterpreted that, I think, in modern times to say he had a high voice. A high voice like Pavarotti versus a baritone, maybe. People who were in the political business in those days had to have a speaking instrument that allowed them to be heard without the kind of electronic amplification that we take for granted today. And if you think about it, people like Reagan, Clinton, and both Presidents Bush could never have been politicians in the 19th century. However attractive or original their ideas, they would have been relegated to the background because they couldn't project the way you need to project. Hmm. I can't even think of who the last president was who had the kind of speaking voice that would have worked in the 19th century. Maybe Nixon, because he had a healthy baritone. So it's a different world, but still people would focus on the obvious until they started listening to the words. And yes, to your point, it was a speech that was intentionally crafted so that you start with very ponderous legalistic stuff just to impress the heck out of these people that he was capable of doing that. I think that was the point of the opening.
Our guest, Harold Holzer, has authored, co-authored, and edited 22 books on Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War. His most recent is about this speech that we have talked about here, a speech that Lincoln delivered at Cooper Union in New York City in February of 1860. And the book is titled Lincoln at Cooper Union, The Speech That Made Abraham Lincoln President. It's published by Simon & Schuster. We have a caller here to bring into the conversation, someone calling from east of Danville, not very far from here, line number 4, our toll-free line. Hello.
Hello, thank you.
Yes.
This is very, very interesting and makes me want to search a lot about Abraham Lincoln. Anyhow, this story was given to me by my father, and he's been deceased for a long, long time. Some of the other family knew about this, too. Abraham Lincoln was on a campaign trail, and we think it was through Indiana, more likely at State Line, Indiana. He stopped there for his speech or whatever. but anyhow, it had to be some kind of a celebration because they had requested singing groups to fill in his presentation. But anyhow, he chose my grandfather and three of his brothers to do the singing. And we have been so excited about this. But anyhow, some of my grandfather's brothers were lawyers. I don't know where, but we all originated here in Indiana. We thought possibly it was on a train, and from what you said, what I caught a while ago, that was probably the case, that But anyhow, I have never looked into the Historical Society about this.
And I'm sure people will think that I'll never know what this is about, but I can actually tell you exactly when and where this happened.
Oh, you can.
I can.
I can take
a really good guess. It was February 11th, 1861.
February 11th, 1861. That sounds about right.
This would have been Lincoln is elected president, and he leaves Springfield in the early morning to go to Washington to be inaugurated. And so he's got to take another one of those long journeys east.
Oh, my.
Well, according to the records, right shortly after noon, the train arrived at State Line.
Oh, it was. Now, do you have that recorded in a book?
Well, it's recorded in many books, including his collected works and including in...
And it did say State Line, Indiana?
Absolutely.
Oh.
Would I make that up?
Oh, no, no.
A committee of state legislators.
What kind of a train, and what was the name of the train?
Well, it was a presidential special. You know, it was the train that was carrying the new president to New York, well, at least on the first leg of the journey. When he got to State Line, there was a committee of legislators there to meet him. I'm sure there was music. It sounds reasonable to me.
Oh, yes. Well, my family was all singers, and especially the men, and they were in a group of four who President Lincoln chose to do the singing.
Well, and there you are, and now you know the date, and I'm absolutely sure it happened. You know, he made a little speech while he was there, and...
you don't have the speech recorded. I don't...
It is recorded. You can
find that particular one is?
The Collected Works of Abraham Lincoln.
Oh, great.
For February 11th. It's very brief. He just says, in fact, I'm looking at it now. Thank you for your kind reception and for all the aid Indiana rendered our cause, which I think a just one. Gentlemen, I shall address you at greater length at Indianapolis. So that was the end of that speech.
So it was going
in the Lafayette, Indiana Courier the next day.
They were going.
You know, you might look, if you can go to your public library.
Well, I just have a little one. Little library. I don't know if they'd have it or not.
If anybody has the Lafayette, Indiana Courier for February 12th, 61, I'll bet you that newspaper has all the details of the celebration.
Oh,
and you could probably even find the names of the singers, and that would be a great thing for your family to have.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, well, I thank you so very much.
My pleasure. It's always great. You're not the first person I've heard whose descendants sang or played music for Lincoln, interestingly.
Uh-huh.
But it's always fun to be able to pinpoint the date.
Yes, and I would love to know what they sang.
Oh, well, I bet you could find it in that newspaper.
Okay. Well, thank
you. Good luck.
You
all right. Well, thank you,
you
for the call. We are, again, as I said, a little bit past the midpoint of this part of Focus 580, and we'd be happy to have questions from people who are listening. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455.
You know, it's amazing how many of these family stories are actually right on the money, that people have these things handed down, and there's, you know, you just do a tiny bit of research, and there it is.
Maybe it would be a good idea for me to ask you to talk a little bit more about the speech.
Mm-hmm.
There, for people who are interested, of course, in the book, Lincoln and Cooper Union, the entire speech is there so that people can read the whole speech. But there is a section where you talk a little bit about something, and you referred to it earlier, that one of the things about the speech that maybe makes it a little complicated is that it's, you can think of it as being three speeches, really. It has these three major sections, and each one is intended to do something a little bit different. Maybe you could just talk a little bit more about the speech and about what it was that Lincoln was trying to accomplish in each of these parts of the speech.
Sure. I'll do it reasonably briefly, I hope. The first section was this legalistic proof that I was speaking about a few minutes ago, that the founders had, in fact, expected the federal government to control slavery. Very long, about 45, 50 minutes of that, counting, recounting, giving all the votes, all the names, repeating the names, and every once in a while going back to that Douglas line, and after all, our fathers who framed the government under which we live understood that question just as well or better than we do now, with a twinkle in his eye and evoking laughter from time to time. Then he says, and now a few words to the South, if they would listen, as I suppose they would not, provoking more laughter. And for the next 30 minutes or so, Lincoln sternly lectures the absent South. I mean, here it's in the first section, he's been sort of arguing against Stephen Douglas, who is not there. Now he argues against the whole South, which, of course, is not there and not likely to read this speech because the words Republican anti-slavery men give are not generally reprinted in the South. Lincoln warns the South that if disunion occurs over slavery, it will be the fault of the South, but no way they can twist the argument can make it rational that it's the fault of anti-slavery people. That they would like to compete in the South for votes, but that Southerners don't let their names appear on ballots. And then he says, but enough. And that's certainly a way to change tone. And he begins his final section, which is to Republicans, to his fellow Republicans. Much as we hate tolerating slavery where it exists, he says, let's accept it for now because the disruption of it would throw the country into utter turmoil, but let's stand fast on the idea that slavery can spread, because if we contain it, if we refuse to allow it to spread, then we can place it on the course of ultimate extinction as our fathers who framed the government wanted it. And don't let anyone ever say that slavery is somehow right, because we know it's wrong. We know it's an evil. Calling it right doesn't make it right. We will prevail. And that's how he leads into the condemnation of what he calls sophistical contrivances, lies, double lies that suggest that there's good in slavery. And he urges the audience, as he closes, let us have faith that right makes might. Don't be afraid to do your duty. We will prevail. And the audience is on its feet, cheering wildly.
Well, we have someone else here who is listening who would like to join the conversation. Let us do that. And the caller's in Villa Grove, and that is line one. Hello.
Hello, Mr. Hauser. I was privileged to see you the other day on C-SPAN and had a question.
Sure.
I couldn't get in to ask. Your book that you wrote was Mario Cuomo, Lincoln on Democracy.
Mm-hmm.
I would like you to tell the audience a little bit about why you wrote the book. And my question is, as I read through it, I noticed about 63, Gettysburg Address, Mr. Lincoln stops using the word union and starts using the word nation. And I think that's probably what we won out of that war. We became a nation. If you could speak to that, please.
I think that that's absolutely true. As my friend James McPherson, the great Civil War historian, puts it, before the Civil War, people used to write, the United States are. And after the Civil War, it was, the United States is. We became provenly indivisible through the sacrifice of much blood and treasure, obviously. And nationhood was achieved. And Lincoln, I think, when he added to the goal of preserving the Union and safeguarding majority rule, added to that cleansing the sin of slavery from the body politic, that was there were three good reasons to reforge and rededicate the nation, as he said at Gettysburg. Thank you for mentioning Lincoln on Democracy, which is going to be coming out this fall in an all-new edition, at least a newly available edition. It's been out of print for so long.
Well, I truly enjoyed the book. Also, I read Robert Johansson's book, Democracy on Trial.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you're familiar with Jefferson Davis's farewell speech in the Senate. And right following that is the Cooper Union. And I think immediately these two very moderate people, at least moderate on the secession, have such strident speeches in there.
Yeah. That's very true. Do you ask me to explain a little bit about how Lincoln on Democracy came to be?
Right, please do.
I was working for Mario Cuomo at the time. I was one of his public affairs specialists in the government, the state government of New York, and he had a visit from representatives of the Solidarity Union of Teachers from Poland, just a state visit. And they asked him if, now that the Iron Curtain was descending, whether he could recommend to them books about democracy, because they had not been privileged to know about democracy in post-war Poland, or indeed during World War II era Poland. And he recommended Lincoln. He said, Lincoln is my favorite. Lincoln is the greatest writer about democracy. And they said, we know Abraham Lincoln well, but we have no books. They were all taken away by the Russians. So the governor said, I will provide a book, not knowing, of course, how he was going to do that, except he called me and said, this is what we have to do. We got seven wonderful Lincoln scholars together to write introductions to different sections. We got a committee of about 50 historians to recommend speeches and letters and documents and put together a collection of all of Lincoln's great words on self-government and freedom. And I'm happy to say that although it's out of print in English coming back, but out of print for a couple of years, it did appear in Polish, in Japanese, and in Hebrew, and even in, although I can't quite figure out why, even in Indonesian over the years. So it's been around and out there, and I hope it really did make a difference to the people in Poland.
Well, I know I was disappointed when I realized it came out in Polish before it came out in English.
It was only a matter of weeks, so it wasn't that long a wait.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank
well,
you.
Thanks for the
Bye-bye.
Call. Let's continue. We'll go to next to caller in Urbana, line two. Hello.
Yeah, I heard Mario Cuomo on C-SPAN talking about that book and Lincoln on Democracy, is it?
Well, I think he was on C-SPAN to talk about his new book, which is called Why Lincoln Matters.
Oh. Well, anyway, well, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Well, I just wanted to ask you quickly. Cuomo mentioned that, Cuomo mentioned that he was impressed about the way Lincoln dealt with the fact that he was not a member of an organized religion. And he said that to be a member of a practice in an organized religion, you have to accept rules and prohibitions created by men, and he just couldn't accept that. And which I too think was a wonderful way to deal with it. And I was curious if you could tell me anything about the problems that may have, if any, that may have come about because of his being rather secular. And I don't know if you mentioned some sort of divine inspiration or something during the Cooper's Union speech, but
he did not. He didn't. But you certainly ask an interesting. You have a very interesting take on it. And wherever I go, even if I'm talking about something completely different, people do bring up the religion issue. It's always a hot button issue, and certainly among the Christian community, there is this battle for Lincoln's soul that's been going on since his death, about whether Lincoln was a true Christian or not. There's really no strong evidence that he ever said much about the Trinity. He was certainly came to very much believe in God and talk about God, especially once he was elected president. I think looking at what lay in front of him and all the challenges he faced, he said, without the assistance of that divine being, I cannot succeed, and with that assistance, I cannot fail. And then as the war progressed, how does someone, without going mad, assume the burden of 600,000 casualties without saying the will of God prevails? It's God, not me. And I think a little bit of his increasing religiosity was a defense mechanism against the awful burden, the awful guilt of all of those sacrifices, all of those casualties. Your specific question was whether he ever got into trouble because of his religious views, and I think early in his career he had to put out a pamphlet making clear that he was not a non-believer, because the rumor had been circulated that he did not, that he was an atheist or an agnostic, which he did not consider himself, or at least thought it was politically imprudent to declare himself as that. This is a man who ran against a minister once for Congress, so he was used to the mix of religion and politics, but he very nearly did get into trouble in a younger period in his career.
Well, I think it's interesting that nowadays I'm not so sure that same argument would have won the day. You know, because
I think you're right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
All right,
thank you.
Let's go on to another caller. This would be line number three, and I believe that's also Urbana. Hello.
Hello, Harold.
Yes.
I'm a member of the Lincoln Forum, and I just I have a question, and also I want to say something else. I've been a member of the Lincoln Forum for 3 years now.
Great.
And pardon me.
Yeah, I said that's wonderful.
Oh, I do too. And I go to about 6 or 7 symposia on the Civil War every year, and this is by far my favorite. So I just wanted to plug it. If anybody's interested in something really wonderful about the Civil War, this is a thing to do. I'm sure it's too late to sign up for this year.
Well, we still have. We should just stop to tell people what the Lincoln Forum is. It's a group of people from around the country who gather every November 16, 17, and 18 in Gettysburg. Simply seemed like a good place to go, and it feeds right into the annual celebration of the Gettysburg Address on the 19th. And we meet and hear speakers and have dinners and banquets and battlefield tours and great group of people from Canada, Los Angeles, Illinois, Pennsylvania, New York. We all get together, and this year, another great roster of speakers, including Mario Cuomo, who we just spoke about. And if anybody's interested,
really
you just go on
that.
The web. It's www.thelincolnforum.org, O-R-G. And about 25 reservations left, so who knows?
Oh, great. That's great. Well, I have a question. I'm going to have to ask the question and then hang up because I'm in the car. My wife wants to hear, too.
Okay.
The radio turned off. I've been unfortunate enough to miss, at least on two occasions, Sam Waterston's Cooper's Union address. I tuned in late, so you might have already talked about this. But is this going to be on a CD, or is there going to be some other opportunity that I'll have to see that?
Well,
with that, I'm afraid I'm going to have to hang up.
Okay. Well, I'll
Thank
talk
you.
To you through the car.
Okay. Radio. Well, thanks very much for the call.
I hope he can still hear. I've gotten a lot of calls about the Cooper Union it's always hard to know when C-SPAN is going to rerun something, but they are going to rerun it. And we are talking about different kinds of ways to package it. Certainly anybody who wants a tape of Waterston reading it can just get in touch with C-SPAN, and they sell their cassettes for something like $30. And I hope they continue to make it available, especially in schools.
Okay, so but they did videotape it, and
it's been broadcast about 5 times already.
Okay, so I know that for people who do have internet access, C-SPAN does have website, so maybe one thing that people can do would be to go to website and see if they can check it out there, because I do believe the C-SPAN schedule there is posted. So
do they, if they do voice streaming too, it's probably still
And I think that they do. I'm pretty sure that they do. Anyway, I'm sure that it's probably cspan.org or something like that, or people could just put C-SPAN into their browser, and I'm sure that they would find it. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Harold Holzer. He's written a lot about Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War. He's the author of a recently published book, Lincoln at Cooper Union, The Speech That Made Abraham Lincoln President, published by Simon & Schuster. I want to talk have you talk for a moment about the photograph, because one of the things that Lincoln did the day of the speech was he stopped by the studio of Matthew Brady and had a picture taken, a photograph made. It's reproduced on the cover of the book. And then after he gave the speech, it was widely reprinted and distributed. But also this photograph was distributed. And you make the argument that that also was significant, maybe not quite as a comment attributed to Lincoln that he had said something like that Cooper Union and Matthew Brady made him president. He may not have said that, but apparently this photograph was pretty important.
It was really important. With all due respect to your part of the country, which I love visiting, the photographs that he'd had made there in the years previous were not terribly flattering. They were, you know, a little too realistic. That long, dark neck and the hair standing up all over the place, that was a typical image. Plus, it was a period in the 50s when photographs could not easily be reproduced anyway. This was just the perfect place to be photographed by the greatest photographer in the country, an award-winning photographer, at a moment when the technology was developing so that pictures could be widely reproduced. And Brady, you know, just retouched the picture. He asked Lincoln to pull up his collar so that his neck wouldn't show so much. He brought in a pillar, or at least a fake pillar, to give Lincoln this dignity and statecraft image. And he was smart enough to sort of pull back. Don't focus just on Lincoln's face, which was a little bit scary in its unretouched version, but to pull back and show the full body, the full Lincoln. And he was an imposing, impressive-looking man, and the big man. And just the combination of intelligence and power and refinement that this picture projected was the perfect accompaniment to the address.
Let's continue here. I think we have somebody else to talk with. The next caller would be in Charleston. That's line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
PBS ran a documentary, a special on Ulysses Grant within the last year or so, and I was struck by one of the comments there that said that in the 19th century, the big popular figure in America was Grant, not Lincoln. And I just wondered if you could comment on that, if that was description or not.
I would say it changed. In 64, when Grant was brought east, 63, 64, Grant was the coming man, and he was so popular, it was even possible that he could have challenged Lincoln for the Republican presidential nomination, which he was too loyal to do. Between 64 and 65, Grant's army suffered a lot of bloodshed, and I'm not sure he was all that popular.
Right.
Nor Lincoln. And then in 65, he wins the war. I mean, he takes Lee's surrender, so he's enormously popular again. But then Lincoln dies, and Lincoln is the most revered figure in the historical figure. He doesn't live to get the benefit of the reverence that descends on him. But I think after Lincoln dies, Grant is the most popular figure in America, certainly in the North. And he, after his presidency and his world tour, becomes the most popular American in the world. He's just known all over the world. So he had the good fortune to live into the rest of the century and be the, or at least for another 15 years, and be the beneficiary of the affection of the North for the success in the war, where Lincoln was just a great figure of memory at that point.
All right, thank you.
All right, thank you for the call. And let's see, we'll go again to Bloomington, Indiana, line number one. Hello.
Hi, I tuned in late. I hope I'm not repeating something you already covered. But about Lincoln's belief in God, several quotations. During the Civil War, Lincoln called for a national day of prayer. Have you discussed that?
We've discussed religion, but not these proclamations.
May I just—it's just about four sentences long, and it takes about 20 seconds. And here's what it says: "We have been the recipients of the choicest bounties of heaven. We have grown in numbers, wealth, and power as no other nation has ever grown. But we have forgotten God. Intoxicated with unbroken success, we have become too self-sufficient to feel the necessity of redeeming and preserving grace. Too proud to pray to the God who made us. It behooves us, then, to humble ourselves before the offended power, to confess our national sins and pray for clemency and forgiveness." And Lincoln also, during his second inaugural address, talked about definitely that the Civil War was a judgment for slavery, where he talked about if every drop of blood drawn by the lash would be paid for by one drawn by the sword before the Civil War was over. One of the most eloquent, he said, "The judgments of God are good."
The judgments
and
of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I said a little earlier that I think Lincoln leaned on God more as the casualties and the destruction of the war became almost out of human scale, and he had to reach back and assume that a higher power was guiding this enormous sacrifice in the name of freedom and unity. But you've read a wonderful passage that's very seldom quoted from that proclamation, and it's seldom remembered as well, that Lincoln is the father, among many other things, of the Thanksgiving holiday in the United States. He declared it annually for so long that he was prevailed upon by, of all people, the author of Mary Had a Little Lamb to make it permanent. So he invented the permanent November holiday. But we should not forget, as you, sir, have recalled, that for Lincoln it was not a day of to stuff yourself with food. It was a day, in fact, the first Thanksgivings that he declared called for fasting and not feasting.
I must jump in here because we're here at the end of the time. If you'd like to read more on the subject that we have mentioned, the book is Lincoln at Cooper Union, The Speech That Made Abraham Lincoln President, by our guest Harold Holzer. Harold Holzer serves as Vice President for Communications and Marketing at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. He is also co-chair of the U.S. Abraham Lincoln Bicentennial Commission and is founding Vice Chairman of the Lincoln Forum. And he's written a number of books about Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War. So you can seek them out as well. Mr. Holzer, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you, and thanks to all the callers for those great questions as well.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. Much of our local production, including interviews from Focus and the Afternoon Magazine, as well as local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen. Just go to WILL.UIUC.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
Support for Focus 580 comes from the Infant Parent Institute. Celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign, the Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infant-parent.com.
And good morning. It's about 3 minutes until 12 noon. I'm Jay Pierce, and this is the Afternoon Magazine now on AM 580 WILL Urbana. And our technical director is Henry Frayne. We have a temperature of 87 degrees on Friends Plaza right now as we head into a noon hour of news and information, including your chance to talk to Ed, meteorologist Ed Kieser. We'll be taking your phone calls about weather. If you have anything planned for the weekend, about 12:40 this afternoon will be the time to get on the line and talk to Ed. In the 1 o'clock hour, we have an archived interview that Celeste Quinn did in May with Natalie Angier, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer for the New York Times, about her book, The Canon, A Whirligig Tour of the Beautiful Basics of Science. That'll be coming up in the 1 o'clock hour. Then a little bit later this afternoon, Jeff Bossert will be in at 2:40. His guest will be Alan Nathan, who is a University of Illinois physics professor who looks at everything factored into a home run, like those hit by Barry Bonds or Alex Rodriguez. Today on the Afternoon Magazine at 2:40, the physics of baseball, Jeff Bossert and guest Alan Nathan. Right now it's time to take a look at how the commodity markets are doing. And the September wheat in Kansas City is trading at 657.5, down 2.75. December at 669.5, down 3.75. September wheat in Chicago at 670.75, down 2.75. December at 688.75, down 2.25. The March contract at 683.25 is down 0.25. September corn 332.25, unchanged. December 349, up 0.25. March 364.75, up 0.25. And December 08, corn is at 399. That's up 2.75. August soybeans 852, down 6. September at 858.5, down 3.5. November contract at 873.75, down 4. And the August soybean meal at 231 is down 130. August oil at 36.43, down 45. August feeder cattle 115.45, up 50. August live cattle 90.52.5, down 27.5. October live at 94.85, unchanged. August lean hogs 73.50, down 42.5. The September crude oil contract at 70.74 is down 85 cents.